Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. You can catch our past programs at www.archive.org/bookmarks/SGL. And you can email your comments and questions to great.speeches@yahoo.com. And now for today's program from the Peace and Freedom Party State Convention in Sacramento, California, a debate among the four presidential candidates occurred on August 1st, 2008. This is part one. It includes Gloria LaRiva, who is the 2008 presidential candidate for the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and the 1994 and 1998 Peace and Freedom Party candidate for the governor of California. It includes Cynthia McKinney, who is the 2008 presidential candidate for the Green Party and served 12 years in the U.S. Congress as a Democratic representative from Georgia. It includes Brian Moore, who has been selected as the Socialist Party USA presidential nominee for 2008. He is a former Peace Corps volunteer, an anti-war and labor rights organizer. And it includes Ralph Nader, who is the 1996 and 2000 Green Party presidential nominee, the consumer rights icon, ran an independent presidential campaign in 2004 and is doing so in 2008.
It's interesting that Actual Business Week came out with an editorial in 2000 saying corporations should get out of politics.
And now, on to the candidates.
I'm Cynthia McKinney, and I'd like to be your Peace and Freedom presidential nominee. I used to be a Democrat, elected to office first to the Georgia legislature, where I served for 4 years, and then to the United States Congress, where I served for 12 years. But last year, I gave myself a birthday present. I left the Democratic Party basically because the Democratic Party left me. The values it enacted into law after it assumed the majority in Congress were no longer my values. Taking impeachment off the table, funding war and occupation in Afghanistan and Iraq, aiding and abetting the illegal spying on people in this country who dared to dissent, and granting immunity to corporations who violated the law now reflects the values of the Democratic Party. Those are not my values. The Democratic leadership has made that party complicit in every bomb dropped, every child killed, every veteran maimed. They are now complicit in war crimes, crimes against humanity, crimes against the peace, and torture. And so I declared my independence from the national leadership that has brought us to this point. On my birthday last year, I did what women and men did 160 years ago, when they declared their independence from the political order of their day that denied women the right to vote. I have now organized the Power to the People campaign, and I've won the Green Party nomination for president. We've invited the country's marginalized and dispossessed, those who feel that their values aren't represented in the current political discourse, to join our Power to the People campaign. We've taken our message into 24 states and up and down the state of California, and we intend to go into every nook and cranny of this country. Our country needs a movement, and our values, the people's values, need to be represented in public policy. I've watched as a splintered and fragmented movement ends up being actually no movement at all. We've got to do better. I hope you, the dedicated activists within the Peace and Freedom Party, will choose to join the Power to the People campaign and help us weave this necessary movement from the disparate strains of progressive activity in this country. In 1964, Fannie Lou Hamer said that she was sick and tired of being sick and tired. And I believe that there's far more of us today from a broad swath of experiences in this country who, too, are sick and tired of being sick and tired. And that's why I'm running. Our country is in too bad a shape. The world is in too fragile a state. The imperialists are on the march and the state of fear is palpable. A new leadership must emerge that has been tested by the fire and that will not compromise our values. Nothing less than the character and the soul of our country are at stake. I understand that today the Democratic presumptive nominee was heckled by three young black men who challenged him on his plans for black America. The corporate media have led us to believe that what we've seen so far in the various horse race campaigns of the two corporate parties constitutes a discussion of race and gender. They expect us to be satisfied with the drivel that we've been given and to stay inside the box that has so meticulously been prepared for us. That's why my example is so important at this time. I want to carry a real message throughout this state and our country about the issues that really matter to all of us. Given the history of this party, I know you have something to say about this, and I hope you will decide to support me. The Reconstruction Manifesto constitutes the platform of our Power to the People campaign. The Reconstruction Manifesto is available on our website, www.runcynthiarun.org. and has 10 planks. Among its highlights, we call for an electoral system that allows us to determine our own destiny and an economic system that provides opportunity, security, and dignity for all. We recognize that electronic voting machines, special interest money, corporate control of the two-party system, a failure to count all votes cast, as well as the blatant and unpunished actions denying some their right to vote, are all effective ways to hamper our ability to exercise our franchise. We demand recognition of rights to education, health care, housing, living wages, and the need for freedom from racism, sexism, homophobia, Islamophobia, gentrification, and police terror. Therefore, elimination of all health, education, home ownership, and social justice disparities must form the foundation of every plank in any acceptable political and economic platform that seeks to address the real concerns of people in this country. We tackle the need for comprehensive federal investment in low-income families and communities with an emphasis on people of color. We acknowledge the continuing plight of Hurricanes Katrina and Rita survivors. We recognize cases like the Gina 6, the Palmdale 4, the San Francisco 8, the ongoing situation with this country's black farmers. We demand repeal of the Patriot Acts, the Secret Evidence Act, and the Military Commissions Act, and other legislation that rolls back civil liberties and threatens the Bill of Rights. We demand full employment now and suggest that national security includes more than throw weight comparisons and missile counts. We state categorically that no child in this country should be raised below the poverty line and that the federal government is obligated to implement an economic policy that provides opportunity for every family to have gainful employment at a guaranteed income. We write that workers must be free to organize and that our country should set a minimum goal of carbon neutrality within the next 20 years. We must promote and enact laws for U.S. corporations that keep labor standards high at home and raise them abroad. Toward that end, it is clear that we need a repeal of NAFTA, CAFTA, the Caribbean FTA, and the U.S.-Peru FTA, justice for immigrant workers, including an end to the Best Worker Program. We also need immigration reform that includes amnesty and documentation for undocumented workers who are already in this country. A complete overhaul of our country's labor laws, beginning with the repeal of Taft-Hartley, is called for. We need justice for victims of corporations that have participated in crimes against humanity, torture, human trafficking, and other illegal activities. Women and men must enjoy equal pay for equal work, and we believe in the full reproductive rights of women. Our platform also recognizes the importance of repair for damages done. To the indigenous people on whose land this country is founded, and to the descendants of enslaved Africans who lag behind on every desirable measured index up to today, We also call for the United States to adopt the United Nations Declaration on Indigenous Rights. Our Power to the People campaign advocates budget priorities that satisfy unmet human needs and states that no ethnically identifiable groups should also be economically identifiable. Sadly, today, that is not true. 43% of the poor are Black and 24% of Latinos are poor. Clearly, the United States budget should focus on reducing poverty and dismantling existing economic disparities, including losses sustained during the current subprime mortgage crisis. We call for an end to police brutality now. We also call for an end to the war on drugs. In other countries, the war on drugs just means toxic spraying and displacement of individuals. We call for an end to the assault on our civil liberties, an end to the lies of the U.S. government around its own participation in the spread of drugs into poor communities in this country. We demand an explanation of why a CIA rendition aircraft crashed in Yucatan with 3.2 tons of cocaine on board. After the crack revelations around this country and the crack epidemic, it is important that we know if the United States government is really fighting or actually fueling the use of drugs. We call for an end to minimum drug sentences and would focus instead the budget on prevention and treatment. Your vote will put me and the Peace and Freedom Party squarely on board with a campaign that is unafraid to address real issues that families talk about every day around the dinner table. Your vote puts an end to explanations that don't explain and conclusions that don't conclude. We reject the notion that there are problems in this country that politics is not supposed to address or that politicians are not supposed to talk about. Our Power to the People campaign demands the opportunity to change the subject. I ask for your vote and your support.
Brian Moore.
Ten minutes.
I would focus on the one on the left.
Okay, thank you.
One.
Thank you, Deborah. And good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen. Good afternoon, Ms. LaRiva. I don't think I acknowledged you earlier. Mr. Nader, Mr. Gonzalez, Ms. McKinney, and my colleague, Stuart Alexander. I was born and raised in Oakland, California, and I attended high school here in Sacramento, California, at Christian Brothers High School at 21st and Broadway, when it was a two-year all-boys school. I remember when Max Baird drove into the courtyard and pulled out a big sack of dimes and threw them to everybody. And that was, he dated back to the 30s and the 40s, and he was, I think, a heavyweight boxing champion for a few years. I also attended a Franciscan seminary in the Missions of California, which has a lot of tradition here in California. There's 21 missions. I spent a year at Cal State University studying political science, and I got my bachelor's degree from the Catholic Seminary down in Mission San Luis Rey, down near Oceanside in Escondido. I then received a master's degree in public administration from Arizona State University, went into the Peace Corps, served 3 years in Latin America. We trained in Puerto Rico, started in Panama, but when the contingent of Peace Corps volunteers was kicked out due to its anti-war activities, I went to Peru and spent another year and a half down there and had the privilege and opportunity to be in the plaza in Chile when Salvador Allende spoke for the first time before 500,000 people. He was a socialist that was democratically elected, as you well know, by the people of Chile and then overthrown by our own government with the help of corporate America, AT&T and the hotel industry and so forth. Our Secretary of State was behind sending ammunition in diplomatic pouches down to Chile, where they assassinated the general in the army, and of course were responsible, if not directly, indirectly, for the death of Salvador Allende and the emergence of Augusto Pinochet, the right-wing dictator that stayed in power for about 20 or 30 years, killed 3,000 people, including four Americans, and it seems like things never change sometimes with our government. Thank you. Last week, I was in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, at the 111th anniversary of the Socialist Party annual picnic. It dated back to 1897. And the state chairman was quoted in a newspaper article the following day that what was significant about this was tradition. Tradition that we are still around, that we're still advocating for issues that sometimes appear to be unpopular to the general population, but in the end, ultimately, we are vindicated. And we hope that is the case again this time around. Eugene Debs began the effort with his colleagues in 1903, advocated child labor laws and workers' comp and the 40-hour work week and Social Security and unemployment insurance and women's suffrage. And of course, you know what happened. That was all implemented by the Democrats in the 30s and 40s. I'm on the ballot in Vermont, and I was nominated to be the nominee for the Socialist Party. These are two of the three multi-tendency socialist parties in the United States. The third socialist party with multi-tendencies is the Peace and Freedom Party. And so I seek the nomination from the delegates here and hope that we can have three out of three this election year. Stuart and I are socialists. We are in favor of the mass working class. We call for the abolishment of capitalism, and we want to establish social ownership. We want to... We also wish to socialize corporations and give control to workers and committees, distributing the ownership amongst the workers and the citizens of the community. We want to eliminate the corporation's right to profit. We do not support free market or believing that we can roll back the wealth to a limited acceptable degree. We do not need to expand an economic system based on maximum profits eliminating their competition. We do not support small business or middle class or any class. We support the majority working class. And that is the essence of the Socialist Party, and we would hope also of the Peace and Freedom Party, and that's what we'd be an advocate for you on your behalf. It is important for the Peace and Freedom Party not to abandon its socialist and working class orientation. It is important that you not drift away from or lose your socialist character. If the Peace and Freedom Party nominates non-socialist candidates to gain a broader and quicker support, then it will be less than socialist, and it will lose its character. If the Peace and Freedom Party becomes a left liberal reformist party versus socialism, it would give up its political essence. It would give up its organizational existence, and it would be replaced by possibly the Green Party or some other similar party. No offense.
There's a new Green Party.
Okay. So Stuart and I run to make sure that the socialist principles will not be eroded. We are not reformers. We want a systemic change. We will take a fraternal approach with you and cooperate with you so that we can achieve this success. Capitalism is dying. It is teetering on the verge of collapse. The economy is in its death throes. Everywhere we turn, we see it, from war to housing, houses in receivership, to a broken healthcare system, to a broadening gap between the rich and the poor, and on and on and on. Loss of benefits, loss of pension, loss of jobs, outsourcing of jobs. We are a democratic socialist party, as you are, and we want to build a movement. We look forward to working together to build a mass socialist-based electoral force in the United States. I will conclude my comments with several quotes from Eugene Debs. Socialist reform must not be confounded with so-called capitalist reform. The latter is shrewdly designed to buttress capitalism, the former to overthrow it. Socialist reform vitalizes and promotes the socialist revolution. Number two, Eugene Debs said, to my mind, the working class character and the revolutionary integrity of a socialist party are of first importance. All the votes of the people would do us no good if our party ceased to be a revolutionary party, or only incidentally, while yielding more and more to the pressure to modify the principles and programs of the party for the sake of swelling the votes and hastening the day of its expected triumph. Third quote, socialism is a matter of growth, of evolution, which can be advanced by wise methods, but never by obtaining for it a fictitious vote. We should seek only to register the actual vote of socialism, no more and no less. In our propaganda, we should state our principles clearly, speak with truth fearlessly, seeking neither to flatter nor to offend, but only to convince those who should be with us and win them to our cause through an intelligent understanding of its mission. And finally, Mr. Debs said, a middle-class party, by whatever name, would still be a capitalist party. For while it might champion little interests against big interests, with a sop to labor, it would still stand for the capitalist system and the perpetuation of wage slavery.
I'm going to do this coin thing one more time, and then I'm going to think of a better way to rotate them. So let's do it one more time, and I'll shake it up. Gloria, heads or tails?
Heads.
Okay, it's heads. Do you want to go next, or do you want to go last?
I will go now.
Okay.
Sisters and brothers, comrades, fellow candidates, thank you all for being here tonight for this historic occasion of the Convention of Peace and Freedom Party this weekend. This has really been the most dynamic process that we've seen in many years in Peace and Freedom, and we have to make sure that it continues and builds. I just arrived midnight last night from Bolivia for an international gathering in solidarity with the progressive government of Evo Morales of the Movement Towards Socialism Party was taking place, who is the first indigenous president of that country, and it just concluded the event I was at. There's a huge struggle raging in Latin America. On the one hand, of course, are the workers, the oppressed, indigenous people, all those fighting for socialist transformation, sovereignty, and self-determination. On the other are the capitalists, the racist reactionaries, especially what we saw in Bolivia, and above all, U.S. imperialism, which has treated Latin America as its neo-colony for the past century. The outcome of this struggle, whether in Bolivia, Peru, Mexico, Cuba, all of this will have a great import for us in the United States. I want to express my support for the other candidates who are seeking the Peace and Freedom Party nomination, all who've had the courage, taken the time, so much sacrifice to run, and raise the issues that the Democrats and Republicans refuse to raise. Cynthia McKinney is my sister and comrade in the struggle against the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan for a number of years against racism and exploitation. I want to congratulate her, and I think we all should, on having won the Green Party nomination, something that she really worked very hard. Her nomination is truly a first for the Green Party. When Ralph Nader entered this year's race and was bombarded by criticism, that's something I'm sure he's accustomed to, by the Democrats, I immediately wrote a piece on my blog supporting his right to run. I've had a very hard time writing many articles, but that was one I felt was important, to the right to run for president and raise the many critical issues. And I want to say that all of us, whether we win the nomination or not, should continue to work together in this election year and beyond. In the limited time we have, I want to focus my remarks on why I believe that as a labor, anti-war, and anti-racist activist, I would be the best candidate for Peace and Freedom Party. If I'm elected as a nominee, I will make it clear across the country, as well as California, that I am the candidate of both Peace and Freedom and the Party for Socialism and Liberation. The PSL, so far, has gained ballot access in Florida, Vermont, Iowa, Washington State, Arkansas, Colorado, New Jersey, and we're completing our petitioning, we will be successful in New York, Mississippi, and we are filing in Utah, Louisiana, and we're ready to start in Wisconsin, Rhode Island, and we hope for more states as well. I believe, now, unlike the mudslinging of the bourgeois candidates who really, in their mudslinging, never address the issues that both are guilty of, war, racism, and profit-making, I want to raise the difference between myself and other campaigns in the nomination in an honest and open way, in a comradely way. It's very important that we clarify some of the differences. And one of the most important issues is that of the undocumented workers, immigrant workers. At the very time that the undocumented are facing the most dangerous offensive by the ruling class, in the forms of laws like that that was recently passed in Mississippi, making it a felony for the undocumented to even work, and by the act of working, the very essence of our existence as people who are not capitalists, and to make them subject to a year's imprisonment before they're then deported to their country, at a time when the government and media are whipping up racism, it is incumbent for Socialists and Peace and Freedom Party to speak out more than ever, the only party that will speak out in this state for the rights of the undocumented, for full rights. And the demand of open borders is something that we should be very proud of in the platform of Peace and Freedom Party. I was a 1994 and 1998 gubernatorial candidate for Peace and Freedom when we spoke out strongly against Proposition 187, got arrested, organized in the schools, and helped march in the historic march in Los Angeles, as well as our demand for health care, education, and anti-U.S. aggression, and so on.
More from the Peace and Freedom presidential candidates and great speeches and interviews after these messages. Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. You can catch our past programs at www.archive.org/bookmarks/SGL. And you can email your comments and questions to great.speeches@yahoo.com. And now, for today's program from the Peace and Freedom Party State Convention in Sacramento, California, a debate among the four presidential candidates occurred on August 1st, 2008. This is part one. It includes Gloria LaRiva, who is the 2008 presidential candidate for the Party for Socialism and Liberation, and the 1994 and 1998 Peace and Freedom Party candidate for the governor of California. It includes Cynthia McKinney, who is the 2008 presidential candidate for the Green Party and served 12 years in the U.S. Congress as a Democratic representative from Georgia. It includes Brian Moore, who has been selected as the Socialist Party USA presidential nominee for 2008. He is a former Peace Corps volunteer, an anti-war and labor rights organizer. And it includes Ralph Nader, who is the 1996 and 2000 Green Party presidential nominee. The consumer rights icon ran an independent presidential campaign in 2004 and is doing so in 2008. And now, on to the candidates.
In 2006, we witnessed the most important progressive development in the workers' movement of the United States ever in U.S. history, to the surprise of virtually everyone, even in the immigrant movement. On May 1st, 2006, millions of workers with no rights, no guarantees, and most with no union did not go to work. According to the New York Times, 250,000 agricultural workers alone participated in the biggest political act. Somehow I keep getting told to speak louder. I don't know if it's the microphone.
She's the one on the left.
Oh, the one on the left. Okay. The immigrant workers in the struggle revived May Day. They didn't have to be told for weeks and weeks what May Day meant and why that day was important. It comes from their consciousness of their own struggle at home. And Peace and Freedom has been very clear on the support for full rights for immigrants. This is not Ralph Nader's position. In one of his quotes, he said, "We cannot have open borders. That's a totally absurd proposition. It would depress wages here enormously, and tens of millions of people from all levels, including scientists and workers, would be pouring into this country. One way is to provide work permits for people who come in and do work for short periods of time that Americans don't want to do. Well, sisters and brothers, over 30 million immigrants are Americans. They live in this country, and the very premise of socialism, that there are no workers, there are no borders in the worker struggle, is something that we cannot make any concession about. The influx of workers is not what depresses wages. It's the inexorable drive of capitalism to depress wages. And workers must go where they can survive and find work. My mother is from Mexico, and all my life I understood the discrimination that she faced as a sweatshop worker, as a maid, and just plain trying to feed us. And if she had brought us in at this time, we would have been always in danger of deportation. There are no borders for capital. That's the essence of globalization. And we must demand full rights, full amnesty. We not only talk about it as a... And I myself have been a longtime activist in the immigrant rights struggle. The socialist perspective, sisters and brothers, is more relevant, more necessary for the critical fight of socialism and socialist ideas. It's a utopian illusion to think we can go back to an earlier, supposedly more just and gentle capitalism. U.S. capitalism in its rise was always characterized by mass genocide of indigenous people, by the slave trade that slaughtered millions and ruthlessly exploited more, and child labor. In the next stage, it was Jim Crow, Chinese exclusion, and the continued disenfranchisement of women, the crushing of unions, the conquest of new colonies, and a new empire. We cannot go back, nor should we want to. We must go forward to the revolutionary reorganization of society on a socialist basis. It's the only way out of the multiple and multiplying crises that we see unfolding today, even on a more accelerated rate in this year than we could ever have imagined when we first started our campaign. And now more millions of more workers who see the unlimited right of companies to make their profit and even have more and more daily basis, not just the Bush administration, but states and local governments find every way that they can weaken the laws to allow capitalists to make more profit, we believe that millions of workers are open to the ideas of socialism today. I just want to say a couple of points. For example, when you talk to people about why education should be free, at first it seems a little ridiculous, but when you say, why should you as a parent or your child go into debt for tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars to gain a skill that's intended to make a profit for the corporations or provide a social service as a doctor or a teacher or a nurse, why should you bear the burden of that? It should be the burden of society and for the benefit of all. Why should the banks get bailed out like Bears and Stearns, J.P. Morgan actually, for the buyout, and those workers who were fooled by the subprime mortgage lending lose their home, the bank gets bailed out, and they're homeless, and the banks stay with the property? All of the ideas of socialism are inherently understood by workers when we, the vanguard, explain it to the people. Whether it's fighting the death penalty as a tool against the working class, whether it's demanding full rights for immigrants, whether it's demanding full rights for all workers, the right to free health care, abolishing every insurance company from auto to life, to everyone should have a right to a peace. We should be very proud to be your nominee for Peace and Freedom Party.
Thank you, Gloria. I am going to be kind of a tough taskmaster on keeping us on time so we can get all the way through our agenda. And for the candidates, so you'll know, John Rieger, who is standing near the exit, is keeping time, and he will signal you when you're down to 5 minutes or 2 minutes or however close we're getting. Now, Ralph Nader will speak. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Deborah. And thank all the candidates. Some of them I've known, worked with Cynthia McKinney and Brian Moore, have good conversations. Gloria LaRiva, I've just met, and Stuart Alexander. Yes? Yes. First, I want to note that I've never been a Democrat and never been a Republican. Ever since I was a youngster, I was enthralled by the role of third parties and independent candidates in American history. And again, and the case is so overwhelming that almost every social justice movement that moved at all was launched, not just with civic movements, but with parallel small parties. Remember the Liberty Party, abolition of slavery, the Women's Suffrage Party, and all the whole variety of parties in the late 19th century, the Greenback Party, the populist labor parties, and they had their rough edges. But without them pushing with the citizen movement, the parallel farmers movement, for example, the two parties would never have paid any attention to these issues. Some of them were really radical parties in the late 19th century. We ought to resurrect that history so that we can have historical roots for what we're all trying to do, because there's a whole memory loss by three generations of Americans who have gone through almost the entire 20th century without having a strong third party. I mean, the last one was the early part of the 20th century. Norman Thomas ran for five successive presidential runs. He was a graduate in the same university I went to, Princeton, and I went to hear him speak as a student. And I walked him back to his inn, and I said, "Well, what do you think your greatest accomplishment is?" And he said, "Having the Democrats steal so many of my ideas." And that reminded me of my father when we were 10 years old. I was 10 years old. We would have these discussions, political discussions, at the dinner table. And one of the questions one day was, he said, "Why do you think capitalism will always survive?" And that was sort of a provocative question. And so we threw out some answers, but they never were the right answers. And we said, "What's the answer?" He said, "Because capitalism will always be able to use socialism to save it." Look what's happening today. There are all kinds of definitions of socialism, and we'll get to them in the next few hours, I'm sure. But when I went down in April 1959 as a correspondent for the Christian Science Monitor to Cuba, and Fidel Castro had just taken over. It was his third or fourth month. And I had an interview with him, and I said, "What are you going to do with the corporations," which tore Cuba apart, and the gambling interests and the sugar companies, and well, we all know what happened. And I said, "What are you going to do with the corporations?" He said, "Well, we'll see how they behave." And at the time, I knew what he was talking about, because they weren't going to behave for sure. And then about 2002, I went down there and with some of my colleagues. And we spent, you may not believe this, but you can't believe how long he talks. We spent 14 hours with him in two nights, you know, from 8 at night until 4 or 5 in the morning. And all he did was eat a few side dishes. And the question I raised with him was this. Why don't you have an international conference on how to build socialist wealth? You see, socialists have been very good at distribution. But for a variety of reasons, some their fault and some not their fault, they haven't solved the problem of building socialist wealth. They do pretty good on education in Cuba, pretty good on health care, but there's a lot of wealth that needs to be built. So I'm not going to go through all the very nice points that the candidates made. I mean, you're not here to hear repetition. But I want to go to another level of how do we motivate people who have been raised to believe, not to think, in the educational system, who've been raised to obey and not to challenge. And that's what we all went through in elementary school and high school, who were never taught the history of struggles of workers and peasants, a very sanitized history of America, for example, the populist progressive movements, given their rough edges, but they did have some pretty fundamental economic theories, and very little of that was discussed. So we're dealing here not just with goals, noble as they are, we're dealing here not just with utopias, and I really like utopias. It has a bad name. Utopias are very important because what they do is they hold the maximum standard of human possibility, the maximum horizon. But what really has to be analyzed is how do you motivate citizens to move toward their goals at a time when tens of millions of Americans are so demoralized because of their condition, how they've been brutalized and disrespected and excluded and underpaid and overcharged and had their children pulled out from under them and commercialized without any protection by the state against these corporate marketeers, violent programming, junk food, junk drink, poisoning their minds and their bodies at age 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and the government not doing anything about it. They're stealing the next generation from us in the most Pavlovian fashion. And so we can go all through all of those. And then the question is, how do you cut the power of these corporations? Now, one of the first things we have to do is talk about stripping the corporations of their constitutional rights, which they now have in equality with human beings. Just imagine this. An artificial entity called the corporation that has no allegiance to communities or to countries or to the world or to the people has the same constitutional rights than real human beings. And as you know, that was done by a rogue Supreme Court decision in 1886 and then followed with other Supreme Court decisions. Corporations should constitutionally be prohibited, and there's no word corporation in our Constitution, constitutionally prohibited from engaging in politics, from engaging in elections, and from lobbying as an entity. Prohibited, period. It's interesting that actual Business Week came out with an editorial in 2000 saying corporations should get out of politics. Now that's something people really resonate to, because you should say the only people who should have constitutional rights are people. Yeah. People. And I look forward to the Peace and Freedom Platform elaborating that a little bit more. By the way, I just came from Utah, where I was required by Utah law to physically be there in order to get on the ballot. Physically be there. Now, I don't see Obama or McCain having to be physically in Utah. And I have to swear, the requisite words. And here's what I swore to. I, Ralph Nader, declare my intention of becoming an unaffiliated candidate for the political group designated as Peace and Freedom for the office of President of the United States. We're helping your colleagues to get, your associates to get on the ballot in Iowa. Our best ballot access guru, he's really an incredible person, Michael Richardson, has pledged that he would provide lots of pro bono time to help you get on the ballot and overcome these incredible obstacles that the two-party dictatorship has imposed on dissent and diversity and choice on the ballot for the American people. We should always remember, dissent is the mother of almost all assent. Test it. Test it. Have anybody challenge you on that one. And so, how do you cut the ground out from corporations in ways that people resonate with their daily rhythms, with their daily values? And I want to just give you a quick list. When you have single-payer health insurance, you eliminate the health insurance companies, period. The majority of the American people support full Medicare government insurance for all, and a new poll in April says that 59% of the physicians support single-payer. So that's the end of the health insurance companies in that area. When you democratize credit and you go down to the neighborhoods, and you have developmental credit unions that are really controlled by the people there who are the cooperatives, you undermine and weaken the financial giants that are now destabilizing with their corruption and their race to Washington for a bailout our entire economy. When you decentralize energy and you have local social solar energy, and energy efficiency, producing huge amounts of jobs in the local community, you drain away the power of the coal and oil and gas companies. When you have decentralized agriculture, you replace the agribusiness giants. Huge support for small farmers, farm to consumer markets, etc. When you engage in this kind of displacement, you are really not having to go into all kinds of frameworks that people are not understanding, have been propagandized against. But what does it do? It shifts power from the few to the many in the daily control of people's lives over their own lives. That's the key. And one more thing. And so the two words I'd like you to discuss in the future, dealing with corporate power, is displacement and subordination. Subordination to the sovereignty of the people, by stripping them of their constitutional rights as human beings have them, and displacement. All of that provides huge opportunity for millions of people to do the little things every day that build the edifice of justice and true freedom and fulfillment of human possibilities. Thank you.
Thank you. Isn't it just amazing having these four great progressives in the room tonight? It's such an honor to have them here. We are going to start with the questions. Each candidate will have a chance to answer each question. It will be 4 minutes each. We're going to ask the candidates, please keep track of the time. Please watch timekeeper at the back in the black hat. And if he tells me it's time, I'm going to stand up and embarrass you until you are finished. And this time I'm going to read the sequence in advance, and I'm going to keep changing the sequence. And this,
I'd like to ask for just a little bit.
Okay.
Instead of like seeming like we have to like violate your standing
up. You don't like me. Don't like
no,
me standing.
No, I appreciate it, but it'd be easier okay. if they just gave us the 30 seconds.
Can you just watch him and when he does that, and to, if he says that means 30 seconds? Okay, got it. Thank you. So for this question, the sequence will be LaRiva, McKinney, Nader, and Moore. 4 minutes each, please. And the time will start when you start talking. By the way, the candidates were given these questions in advance, and so they knew that they were coming, but they don't know that, well, they don't know which ones we're going to use because we'll run out of time before we get to all the questions. This question is, what should the U.S. military role be in Iraq, in Afghanistan, in Iran? What should the U.S. non-military role be? And if there are other countries you want to discuss at the same time, please go ahead. And so, LaRiva, McKinney, Nader, and Moore. Thank you.
Well, I would call for the immediate removal of all U.S. troops abroad from the more than 700 bases that exist. There can be no discussion of helping a country have proper elections or, you know, fixing their government, because any kind of U.S. presence means U.S. interference and repression, intimidation, and fear. For reparations for all those countries that have been harmed by U.S. policy, from Iraq to Afghanistan, any country that's been affected by war, include everywhere in the world, El Salvador, Nicaragua, all the people who've been harmed. There's plenty of money and wealth in this country. To apologize for the victims in Japan for the atomic bombing, which has never been done in this country, it's one of the biggest crimes, and it has always been excused by every political leader in the United States. But basically, what we have to do right now, sisters and brothers, is not only have a theoretical stance on the issue of war, we have to fight every day. And I have been a longtime activist against the U.S. war, especially from 1990, before the beginning of the war, the first Gulf War, and even before that, when Grenada was bombed and invaded Panama and so on. And so therefore, it requires for a candidate to also be a very, very active in the anti-war movement. And within the anti-war movement, because we're talking about military, there's something that some in the movement want to ignore, and that is the question of Palestine. Not only should we demand an end to all funding for Israel, but we should also call for the right of the Palestinians to self-determination. And most of the time people think, well, it's such a mess in Afghanistan, and you know, you hear about that in the media or from comments. But really the problem is, the root cause is U.S. and other imperialist countries' invasions.
I would just like to make a caveat here that while perhaps the candidates all received the questions in advance, my internet connection was down. So what I would suggest for our role in Iraq, Afghanistan, and Iran is, first of all, there is no justifiable military role in any of those countries. I would bring, as Gloria has said, I would not only bring our troops home from those countries, I would bring our troops home from all countries in which U.S. soldiers are stationed. So in weapons transfers, I sponsored legislation that would stop all weapons transfers of conventional weapons to countries that didn't respect human rights, something called the Arms Trade Code of Conduct, something that is desperately needed in our country. I would take nuclear power off the table, and I would also take nuclear weapons off the table, encourage nuclear-free zones by starting with our own arsenal itself. Then I would join with Gloria in a discussion of how do we repair these countries. For example, I had the opportunity to travel to Pakistan, and I visited a refugee camp there on the border of Afghanistan inside Pakistan. And these were people who had been in this refugee camp since the very first U.S. intervention, which is a result of the Soviet presence in Afghanistan. And I asked the people there, do you know what capitalism is? Do you know what communism is? And these people don't know what capitalism is or what communism is, but they're caught up and they're victims of these highfalutin, high-sounding words that are used by people in high powers that basically treat them as pawns on a chessboard. And so we've got to have a military policy that secures our country, because that's why we have a military, but that it doesn't do any harm anywhere else in the world. And our policies ought to be to lift people up all over the world so that they can enjoy the fruits of what this country can offer.
And very briefly, the criminal aggression, the unconstitutional, illegal invasion, occupation of Iraq must end by giving Iraq and its oil back to the Iraqis. That's the only way. That means a strict 6-month withdrawal of all U.S. military and corporate forces from Iraq, during which there would be UN-sponsored election, continued humanitarian aid, and the negotiation for a requisite minimum autonomy between the Shiites, Sunnis, and Kurds within a unified Iraq, which they all want.
More from the Peace and Freedom presidential candidates and great speeches and interviews after these messages. Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. You can catch our past programs at www.archive.org/bookmarks/SGL. And you can email your comments and questions to great.speeches@yahoo.com. And now, for today's program from the Peace and Freedom Party State Convention in Sacramento, California, a debate among the four presidential candidates occurred on August 1st, 2008. This is part one. It includes Gloria LaRiva, who is the 2008 presidential candidate for the party for Socialism and Liberation, and the 1994 and 1998 Peace and Freedom Party candidate for the governor of California. It includes Cynthia McKinney, who is the 2008 presidential candidate for the Green Party and served 12 years in the U.S. Congress as a Democratic representative from Georgia. It includes Brian Moore, who has been selected as the Socialist Party USA presidential nominee for 2008. He is a former Peace Corps volunteer, an anti-war and labor rights organizer. And it includes Ralph Nader, who is the 1996 and 2000 Green Party presidential nominee. The consumer rights icon ran an independent presidential campaign in 2004 and is doing so in 2008. And now, on to the candidates.
But they worked out this autonomy in the 1950s before the dictators took over. In that way, what we'll do is lay the groundwork for the criminal prosecution after January 20, 2009, of George W. Bush, Dick Cheney, and Donald Rumsfeld. We must stand for a free Palestine. They have already conceded 78% of Palestine to the Israelis. And the Israeli government wants more. They want more colonization, more theft of land, more theft of water. They want more pummeling and brutalizing the Palestinian people. They want more blockades of Gaza, the greatest open-air prison in the world today. Humanitarian crisis, electricity blockade, food blockade, drinking water blockade, medicine blockade. People are dying because they can't have dialysis, they can't have anti-cancer treatments. Apart from the 400-to-1 ratio of Palestinian casualties, Israeli casualties in the last year over the Gaza Israeli border. 400-to-1. And Obama doesn't even recognize the suffering of the Palestinian people when he went over there. Doesn't even visit a refugee camp. Doesn't even want to have a press conference with Abbas because he might be required to say something about the Palestinian side of that conflict. Afghanistan. That was a very, very stupid move. What we should have done to try to get the backers of the attackers is a multinational force that is very focused, not completely blow apart and destabilize Afghanistan and turn it into the number one narco state in the world. How's that for a boomerang? We've got to get out of there. It is a complex thing because we owe the Afghani people. We owe the Afghani people more than just a withdrawal. We owe them help in many ways. This country has got to become a humanitarian superpower in all dimensions. Yeah. And cut that military budget and put that money back into public works in this country.
On a personal level, back in 2002, we formed an anti-war group in Florida and objected to the war resolution and protested in the streets and put out news releases and lobbied our congressmen and so forth. And, of course, the majority party in the U.S. Senate at the time were the Democrats, and they endorsed the resolution to go to war. And it seems like it really doesn't matter whether it's the Republicans or the Democrats. They're both involved in corporate recipient of big money, and therefore have compromised their principles and seek solutions just to ensure that their re-elections can be secured. The military is becoming obsolete, if not already obsolete, and the only way they can justify their existence is to declare a war on drugs, a war on poverty, a war on terrorism, some kind of war so that it can justify their budget, that they can still continue to get big money or sell weapons around the world. And then when it happens to get into the hands of some government that they hadn't planned on, then all of a sudden they turn turkey and, it's not the right thing to do. The essence and the root of whether it be Iraq or Afghanistan or Pakistan is that our for-profit corporations force the government and the politicians to legislate and allocate to protect their interests. And until we eliminate the for-profit corporations, we're going to continue to go to war every other year. So, and until we transfer the defense industry contractors, probably in every single congressional district in this country, 435 congressional districts, and probably most of our universities who get big contracts from the defense industry, we're going to continue to have this self-interest. And that's one way to stop the war in Iraq and potentially in Iran and in Afghanistan. We have called for the closing of all U.S. military facilities, and we are calling also for an immediate and unconditional withdrawal of our forces and corporations from Iraq and Afghanistan. And part of the problem, if not directly related to it, is our aid to Israel and its occupation of the West Bank and Jerusalem and Gaza. And it's somehow its desire not to seek peace. I mean, many times I've gone to Mr. Nader's talks, and he's talked about the peace movement in Israel, but we never hear about that peace movement. And it seems like Israel does a good job of covering it up. We call for the abolition of the Central Intelligence Agency and all intelligence agencies who basically operate to protect corporate interests. Again, the essence, the root cause of our problems. We want unconditional disarmament by the United States. We want to outlaw all weapons of mass destruction, including the use of depleted uranium. And we want an immediate 50% cut in the military budget, and then another 50% 5 years later. We do not need the military. We need a police force, and we need a small military. But we have weapons now that will destroy all of us over and over again. And we call for an end to the U.S. arms sales throughout the world. That has been basically the root of our problems as well.
Thank you. You've been listening to the Peace and Freedom candidate debate in Sacramento, California on August 1st, 2008. And coming up next, from the Commonwealth Club of California, San Francisco, California, on April 21st, 2008, features Gene Healy on the bipartisan romance with the imperial presidency. Gene Healy is the author of the book The Cult of the Presidency: America's Dangerous Devotion to Executive Power. He discusses how the role of the president has changed from the vision of the framers of the Constitution and the obstacles to returning it to its narrow constitutional function. Gene Healy is an American pundit, journalist, and editor.
Who do these folks think they are? And what sort of job is it that they think they're applying for? But very few Americans actually think to ask those sorts of questions. Very few Americans really seem to think there's anything weird about the way we talk about the presidency, the way the candidates talk about the presidency. And nobody really notices anything odd about the fact that the candidates refer to the president in terms that suggest that the officer running for is a combination of guardian angel, shaman, and supreme warlord of the earth.
And now on to the Commonwealth Club of California and Gene Healy.
Fora TV, the world is thinking.
And now it's my pleasure to introduce our distinguished speaker. Gene Healy is senior editor at the Cato Institute and author of a new book, The Cult of the Presidency, America's Dangerous Devotion to Executive Power. He's a contributing editor to Liberty Magazine and the author of a number of Cato studies on executive power abuses by presidents of both parties, including Arrogance of Power Reborn, the Imperial Presidency and Foreign Policy in the Clinton Years, 2001, and, with Timothy Lynch, Power Surge, the Constitutional Record of George W. Bush in 2006. Healy also edited the 2004 book, Go Directly to Jail, The Criminalization of Almost Everything. He's appeared on PBS's NewsHour with Jim Lehrer in NPR's Talk of the Nation, among other venues. And his writings have been published in the Los Angeles Times, the Chicago Tribune, and elsewhere. He holds a BA from Georgetown University and a JD from the University of Chicago Law School, although he is what he calls a recovering lawyer. He grew up in Springsteen country on the Jersey Shore, but has long since become what he calls a self-hating Washingtonian. Perhaps we'll hear more about that. Healy lives in the district's Mount Pleasant neighborhood, about 2 miles north of the White House. His attitude toward public affairs can best be summed up in the words of Elvis Costello: "I used to be disgusted, now I try to be amused." Please join me in welcoming Gene Healy.
Thanks. Thanks for that terrific introduction, and thank you all for being here. Now, this is my first book, and as Tom mentioned, it's called The Cult of the Presidency, but lately I've been thinking that I should have called it The Futility of Hope. So I hope you're not here for a dose of sunny optimism about the state of our politics and about the future of presidential politics, because, man, are you going to be disappointed. Let's think about that phrase, the audacity of hope. I haven't read the book, but I did listen to the keynote speech at the 2004 Democratic Convention, where Barack Obama uses the phrase. And it becomes clear that the audacity of hope is the promise of redemption through presidential politics, right? It's the idea that the president can save us, that when it comes to whatever ails us, whether it's unemployment or hurricanes or even spiritual malaise, the president is the person who has the cure. As Barack Obama put it in his speech in South Carolina a couple of months back, with the right kind of leadership, we can, quote, create a kingdom right here on earth. Now, I don't mean to pick on Barack Obama, because I actually really like him. On a personal level, he seems like a terrific guy, and he's also been picked on enough recently. He's been having a bad couple of weeks. And the fact is, he's far from the only major political figure who subscribes to this, let me see if I can get this off here, who subscribes to this messianic view of the presidency. For example, John McCain worships Teddy Roosevelt, who's perhaps the most ridiculous, obnoxious, and militaristic figure ever to occupy the Oval Office. And McCain says that Teddy Roosevelt is a great president because, among other things, he liberally interpreted the Constitution and dramatically expanded the powers of the office. And he also, according to McCain, Teddy Roosevelt, quote, nourished the soul of a great nation. And if soul nourishing is the president's job, then I guess that's a good thing. Amazingly enough, Mike Huckabee struck a similar note at the start of his campaign. I was watching this on Meet the Press in January, about, I guess it must have been 2 years ago, when he announced his campaign. He said that Tim Russert asked him, "Why are you running for president?" And Huckabee's answer was, "Well, Tim, I think America needs the kind of positive, optimistic leadership that can turn this country around to see a revival of our national soul." A revival of our national soul. Now, you have to remember that at this point, Mike Huckabee is a guy who's famous basically because he used to be really fat. And he's going to save our national soul. Which makes you wonder, you know, is the national soul really in that bad shape? Does it really need Mike Huckabee? Is he the last best hope for America? In any event,
you could be excused when you listen to this sort of thing to ask, who do these folks think they are? And what sort of job is it that they think they're applying for? But very few Americans actually think to ask those sorts of questions. Very few Americans really seem to think there's anything weird about the way we talk about the presidency, the way the candidates talk about the presidency. And nobody really notices anything odd about the fact that the candidates refer to the president in terms that suggest that the office they're running for is a combination of guardian angel, shaman, and supreme warlord of the earth. Well, I think that's odd, and I think that that view of the presidency couldn't be further from the Founding Fathers' perspective. The Founding Fathers were, as we all know, very flawed men, very flawed people, as we all are, but they had a few things right. And their view of the presidency was not of this figure that could solve all large national problems, let alone save your soul. The framers of our Constitution knew human nature far too well to ever think of investing so much power and responsibility in the hands of any one person. Well, my book is about how far we've traveled from the framers' modest view of the chief executive. And it's about how the demands that Americans place on the office virtually guarantee that we will have an imperial presidency, that we will have too much power in the executive branch. When I first got started researching it, my idea was to focus on the sorts of things we've heard so much about for good reason. You know, my idea was to focus on the post 9/11 presidency. The book that I had in mind was going to be another book about some of the claims that the Bush administration has made in the course of the war on terror. And, you know, these are some pretty staggering claims. The Bush administration at various times has claimed that that they can launch wars at will, wiretap without ever having to answer to a judge, and lock up, in the Padilla case particularly, lock up an American citizen picked up on American soil for the duration of the war on terror, which, in other words, could be forever. These were staggering claims, and these were these things were what motivated me to start writing the book. But as I got into the research, it soon became much broader, which is good, because the sort of book that I had in mind at the time is something that's been written about 17 times since I got started. And some of those books, the books on the Bush-Cheney imperial presidency, are terrific books, and I'm glad they're out there. I would recommend one in particular to you, which is by Charlie Savage, called Takeover. The subtitle is The Return of the Imperial Presidency and the Subversion of Democracy. Just a fantastic book. But when I got into the book, when I started researching, and I'm a slow writer, so everybody beat me to the punch on this, but I hit on a number of themes after the book became much broader that I don't think have really gotten enough attention in our current debates over presidential power. In the time that I have here, I just want to touch on three of those themes. First, I want to talk a little bit about, I've referred to the narrow and modest and sort of unromantic conception of the presidential role that the framers had. And second, I'd like to talk a little bit about one important obstacle to restoring the sort of presidency that the framers had in mind.
And the name of that obstacle is situational constitutionalism. And I'll explain that in a few minutes. Finally, in keeping with the general tone of unrelenting pessimism and cynicism that I've set out here, I want to close by suggesting that if we want to restore the constitutional presidency, if we really want to limit the powers of the office and bring it closer to what the office was originally intended to be, then it's going to take a whole lot more to do that than just replacing George W. Bush. Okay, so first, more about the framers. The framers never thought of the president as this combination miracle worker and faith healer who would invest our lives with meaning. Contrary to John McCain, they never thought that the president's job was to nourish the national soul. Hamilton, in Federalist 69, when he's arguing against some of the claims that the Anti-Federalists had made about how great this office would be and how powerful it would be, Hamilton says that the president would have, quote, no particle of spiritual jurisdiction. This was not somebody that was supposed to heal your spiritual malaise. It was a very narrow office. As you know, it's common in these days, especially after 9/11, to hear people call the president our commander-in-chief. This is very prevalent. And in fact, actually, just a couple of weeks ago, Hillary Clinton, in a speech at University of Pennsylvania, trying to distinguish herself from Barack Obama, said, "The president needs to be ready on day one to be commander-in-chief of the American economy," which is, as a colleague of mine said, "We eagerly await your orders, ma'am." But George Washington never went around referring to himself as everybody's commander-in-chief. Most often when he referred to the office he held, the title that he held, he called the office the chief magistracy, which is a very humble, very modest sort of title. And Washington also, unlike the modern George W., didn't think that his command of the military, his role as the first general of the United States Army, gave him the right to pick and choose which countries he would invade or violate whichever laws he thought got in the way of national security. In fact, Washington didn't even think that he had the power to, without going to Congress first, to deal with hostile Indian tribes unless they had attacked first. There's a 1793 letter from him to, I believe it was the governor of Georgia at the time, where Washington says, "I can't help you out because, quote, the Constitution vests the power of declaring war in Congress. Therefore, no offensive expedition of importance can be undertaken until after they shall have deliberated upon the subject and authorized such a measure." What was even more interesting to me when I got into the book, also I should say, at any point if anyone wants to interrupt me, since we're sort of a small informal group, you know, just go ahead and ask a question. I just don't want to feel like I'm just talking at you. When I got into researching the book, I'd known a little bit about this, but still what I found out surprised me, and I wasn't doing... You know, this is ground that's been well covered. It's just that I didn't know it. In addition to the limits on the president's powers in the Constitution, which I'd known about, there were all sorts of informal and cultural limits on what the proper role of the president was. It wasn't considered proper by, you know, either wing of the political spectrum in the late 18th century for the president to use Theodore Roosevelt's bully pulpit. The role of the president was not to go out on the stump and try to move the masses and get everyone behind a program to centralize power. In fact, you know, the norm was that the office of the presidency was not to be sought or declined. I mean, can you imagine a time when the office of the presidency was of the presidency heavily sought? Amazingly enough, as well, the early Republican norm, small r Republican, the best version of that word, the early Republican norm was that the president was mostly supposed to keep his mouth shut.
More from Gene Healy and great speeches and interviews after these messages. Welcome to Great Speeches and Interviews on Access Sacramento and The Voice. And we're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California from San Francisco, California on April 21st, 2008, which features author Gene Healy on the bipartisan romance with the Imperial Presidency. Gene Healy is the author of the book, The Cult of the Presidency: America's Dangerous Devotion to Executive Power, and he discusses how the role of the president has changed from the vision of the framers of the Constitution and the obstacles to returning it to its narrow constitutional function. Gene Healy is an American political pundit, journalist, and editor.
Early presidents gave an average of three public speeches a year. A lot of these were mostly ceremonial. They were not highly political. And, well, obviously, as you know, that's changed. I mean, one statistic that suggests how much it's changed is that in his first year in office, President Clinton gave over 600 public speeches. But the framers thought of the presidency as more of a check, as more of a negative role. He wasn't supposed to be this tribune of the people. His main role was defensive. He had the power, as they said at the Constitutional Convention, to repel sudden attacks, not to make sudden attacks on countries that didn't threaten us. Another way in which his role was defensive was if you look at the Federalist Papers, they seem to conceive of the president's role as, well, they say, Madison says that in a monarchical government, the president is the executive branch is most to be feared. But in the sort of government that we've designed, Madison says, the legislative power is most to be feared because we've confined the executive. The executive powers are, as he says, quote, carefully limited both in extent and duration. And, you don't really hear that from the Federalist Society very much these days. So, in any event, the president's role, as conceived of by the founders, was far narrower, far less public, far less vocal, and far less powerful than what both parties seem to conceive of as the president's role today. Well, how we got here from there is a long story, and nobody can really do it justice. I have a chapter on that in my book, and rather than attempt to say anything about that here, I encourage you to look at that. What I'd rather do in the time we have remaining is to focus on the factors that keep us from getting back to perhaps not the original modest role of the, not entirely back to the chief magistracy that Washington occupied, but getting back to a more humble and less aggressive view of the presidency, which I think most of the country thinks we should have now. Well, one of the factors that keeps us from reining in the imperial presidency is red team, blue team political tribalism. You know, this idea that this should be all too familiar now. This idea that you support your where I come from, and when I talk to people who are Republicans, it's root for the red team. If they don't win, it's a shame. The idea is to throw all your principles out and just back up the faction that you conceive of as your team. Another example I think of is when Bill Clinton was suffering scandals for his goatish behavior in the White House, the Republicans wanted his head. And then when your current governor was running for office and it came out that he'd done some sort of similar things, if you looked at Republican or so-called conservative publications, they thought it was not the same thing at all, although it seemed to be exactly the same sort of behavior to me. Anyway, this tribalism, this partisanship is one of the things that keeps us, the lack of consistent principle over time is one of the things that keeps us from reigning in the imperial presidency. The title of this talk is The Bipartisan Romance with the Imperial Presidency. And it is bipartisan because the difference between the parties is not that significant on the issue of presidential powers. But the romance goes hot and cold. It depends for many people on who is actually in office at any given time. I referred to the phrase earlier, situational constitutionalism. And situational constitutionalism, one of the great obstacles to reigning in the powers of the presidency, is basically a term for a syndrome that seems to be endemic to modern politics. It's the all too common tendency to change all your political principles as soon as your buddies are in office. And there's no greater example of this than the career of Arthur Schlesinger Jr., who is the liberal historian who popularized the term the imperial presidency. Now, the thing with Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and the imperial presidency is a great book, and it was an important book at the time, but the thing with Schlesinger is that he only really hated the imperial presidency when Republicans were in office. In his long career, Arthur Schlesinger Jr. was a loud cheerleader for Truman's undeclared war in Korea, and then he went to work for JFK in the White House, and he was completely captivated by the romance of Camelot. But he, around the time that Richard Nixon got elected, and to be fair, Schlesinger had reservations about Vietnam, around the time that Richard Nixon got elected, and after it was very clear in the LBJ administration that the Vietnam War was a disaster, Schlesinger started to realize that maybe unchecked power might not be such a great idea after all. And so he wrote the book, The Imperial Presidency. And Schlesinger kept up his critique during the Reagan and Bush 41 administrations. But then in 1992, the blue team took back the office of the presidency, and the red team tried to impeach the president. And there's a classic New York Times op-ed that Schlesinger wrote where he expressed his outrage at the impeachment attempt. And the op-ed is called So Much for the Imperial Presidency. And in the op-ed, Schlesinger sounds as if he's kind of sad that it's gone. I mean, this was an institution that he had complained about and had thought was a real threat to American liberty and the American constitutional order. But, of course, the imperial presidency wasn't gone. Not long after Schlesinger wrote those words, so much for the imperial presidency, Bill Clinton launched a major undeclared war with Serbia. And this war in 99 didn't follow the typical pattern of 20th century presidential wars. Usually what happens in 20th century presidential wars is that the president launches the action and Congress says nothing. Well, this was different because, thanks in part to a Bay Area congressman, Tom Campbell, who's no longer in office, Congress actually voted on this, and Congress voted down authorization for the war in Serbia over Kosovo. Now, whatever your opinion of that war, whether it was a good idea or not, Congress voted and voted it down. And so this was actually the first time that I know of where a president had kept troops in theater in actual active combat in complete defiance of the War Powers Resolution, and more importantly, in outright defiance of an up or down vote by Congress. And this happened, you know, just a month or two after Arthur Schlesinger Jr. had complained that the imperial presidency was gone. Well, Schlesinger never complained about this particular war. In fact, one of his last books was the 2004's War in the American Presidency, which is a screed against the Bush administration, mostly justified. But he never mentions the Kosovo War because, you know, too many people have a blind spot when their faction, the clique they support, actually is exercising power. Again, on these issues, the right side of the political spectrum is just as unprincipled as is the left. I have a section in the book called How Conservatives Learn to Stop Worrying and Love the Imperial Presidency. Because, I mean, one of the interesting things about the conservative movement is that, you know, at its inception, it was against concentration of power in the executive branch. Post-New Deal, conservatives gave us the 22nd Amendment, limiting presidential terms. The intellectuals who coalesced around William F. Buckley's National Review were almost to a man critics of presidential power. They associated presidential power with activist liberalism, with the New Deal, with the New Frontier, and they styled themselves as people who were against concentrations of power and wanted decentralization of power. Barry Goldwater, who was the standard bearer early on for their vision of politics, wrote in 1964 that some of the current worship of powerful executives may come from those who admire strength and accomplishment of any sort. Others hail the display of presidential strength simply because they approve of the result reached by that use of power. This is nothing less than the totalitarian philosophy that the end justifies the means. If ever there was a philosophy of government totally at war with that of the founding fathers, it is this one. That's Barry Goldwater. But, you know, of course, Ronald Reagan rose to prominence by making, for other things, but one of the ways he got put on the national scene was by making a televised speech supporting Goldwater's candidacy. And in it, you know, you find some of the same sentiments. Reagan attacked Senator Fulbright for making a speech in which he had, quote, referred to the president as our moral teacher and our leader, and he said that he is hobbled in his task by the restrictions on power imposed on him by this antiquated document, the Constitution, right? He must be freed, Fulbright said, so that he can do for us what he knows is best. Now, Reagan, in this famous speech that all the conservatives love, treated that idea with total contempt. He said it was one of the things that could lead us to what he called the ant heap of totalitarianism. This is the kind of talk that in the modern conservative movement would lead people like Rush Limbaugh or Sean Hannity to call for your head, to suggest that you should be prosecuted for treason. But this was what this was actually a core principle of the conservative movement long ago. If you want an object lesson in what in this concept of situational constitutionalism, this idea that your view of what the document requires changes based on changing political circumstances, I don't think you could do any better than to look at leading organs of conservative opinion like the National Review and the Wall Street Journal just over the last 15 years or so. In the 1990s, I've read a lot of these and fairly often, and in the 1990s, in the 1990s, the National Review and the Wall Street Journal were trying to convince the country that the presidency had been seized by a person of sort of unparalleled corruption, right? A guy who, was a crook, a felon, possibly a rapist, and certainly someone who could never be trusted with power. And they've spent the last 7 years trying to tear down every conceivable constitutional check on the office's power. And this is what really I find hard to believe, is they've done this all the time, where until very recently, the odds-on favorite to win the office was someone who was also named Clinton and who had been there and who they had denounced repeatedly during this time as being another amoral person. Well, whatever you think of the charges that they leveled at the Clintons, I think the point is that constitutional checks exist. Constitutional checks exist so that even when you have that when parties change and when you get people that are not fit to be trusted with power, if anyone's fit to be trusted with as much power as the modern presidency, that the country is still safe because one man or one woman cannot make the decision by themselves to take the country into war, to wiretap without a warrant, to lock up American citizens without a trial, to do any and all of these things that the conservatives have gleefully lobbied for in the last 7 years. That's my little episode of Republican and conservative bashing for this talk. But let me also suggest to you that there's been a lot of excitement about the coming election from people on the other side of the political spectrum, and you get the impression from them that they think that all we need to do is usher out George W. Bush, and all we need to do is elect a Democratic president, the problems of the presidency, the problems of undue concentration of executive power are going to be gone. Well, I don't agree with that at all. When George W. Bush returns to the ranch in 2009, which will be 273 days, 3 hours, 40 minutes, and 18 seconds from now. Somebody got me this for Christmas. You can count it down like Christmas is coming. But when he goes back to the ranch, the problems of the imperial presidency are going to remain. And they're going to remain because it was not simply ideological hardliners and people dedicated ideologically to the expansion of presidential powers that are responsible for the concentration of power in the executive branch. That's too simple a story to say that the reason we have the presidency we do and the reason that we've experienced what we have over the last 7 years are because of a cabal of neocons. When a Democrat takes the office, I do not think our problems with the imperial presidency are going to go away. Because first, the record of past Democratic administrations, including the Clinton administration, gives us very little reason to believe that the Democrats are going to hesitate to expand the powers of the office. The second reason I don't think these problems are going away is that there are going to be enormous pressures in the post-9/11 world to revert to the Bush theory of presidential power if and when there are further terrorist attacks. Now, I don't believe that terrorism is, in the phrase you so often hear, an existential threat to America. But I do believe it's very easy to pull off things like car bombings and shootings in malls and so on. And when that happens, I think whoever is in the office, even someone who's ideologically opposed to expanding presidential power, is going to be under enormous political pressure to dust off the Bush theories. If the president is held accountable, I mean, no president can reliably terror-proof the entire domestic United States, and no president should be expected to. But the expectation is exactly the problem. If the president is held accountable, if the president suffers political punishment anytime he or she fails to prevent the unpreventable, then, well, obviously the incentive there is for the person who's held accountable to seek power to match the responsibility that's placed on them. I don't know are you familiar with Jack Goldsmith? Jack Goldsmith is a man who wrote, he's on The Daily Show last week. He's the guy from the Office of Legal Counsel who headed the office. This is the Justice Department's office that issues legal opinions that are binding on the executive branch. This is the office that those cheery torture memos that we've been reading so much about emanated from. Well, Jack Goldsmith is a guy that that took over the Office of Legal Counsel in 2003, and he wrote a book in 2007 called The Terror Presidency. And when Goldsmith went to the Justice Department, he repudiated several of the legal opinions issued by John Yoo, Berkeley's famous John Yoo, the torture memos and several others. So Goldsmith, was somebody, and this in that political context, took a fair amount of courage. I mean, Goldsmith is a guy who says he's no civil libertarian. He admits that. But he found some of the opinions that were issued in the name of the administration and that actually affected policy to be shoddy, badly reasoned, and offered in bad faith and dangerous. And so he repudiated them. He repudiated them. But in his book, The Terror Presidency, Goldsmith explains that it wasn't just neoconservative ideology that was behind these staggering claims of executive power. Because everyone who worked in the White House, as he describes very vividly, knew that the president would be held responsible for the next attack, wherever it came from. And because of that, the people in the office thought that the president needed power to match that responsibility. Goldsmith writes that, grab the quote here, "For generations, the terror presidency will be characterized by an unremitting fear of attack, an obsession with preventing the attack, and a proclivity to act aggressively and preemptively to do so. If anything, the next Democratic president, having digested a few threat matrices and acutely aware that he or she alone will be wholly responsible when thousands of Americans are killed in the next attack, that president, even a Democratic president, will be even more anxious than the current president to thwart the threat." I don't agree with that view of the threat, and I don't agree at all with that view of presidential responsibility, but I think probably he's right about the political dynamic that's going on here. An explosion goes off somewhere in the country. We learn that it's not domestic, that it may have al-Qaeda connections. I think all eyes will be on the president to, what is he doing to keep us safe? What more is he prepared to do? And in that political environment, some of the Bush theories of executive power that allow you to skip the inconvenience of going before a judge, going before courts, asking Congress, consulting with Congress, I think that will look very tempting. Even to, or maybe even especially to a Democratic president suspected of being, quote, soft on terror. having set out the problem, I suppose that I'm expected to suggest a solution. But my time is almost up, so I guess I can't. But let me leave you with this. Everyone wants a 5-point plan, and everyone, of course, there are legislative and judicial reforms that should be made to rein in the terror presidency, what Goldsmith calls the terror presidency. These things are very necessary, but they're not by any means sufficient, because for any reform to stick, you can design the best statute you want, but to get Congress to pass it, to get the courts to uphold it, to give backbone to people who support it, the people have to support it. It has to reflect the popular will, and there needs to be a change in public sentiment, because when people look to the president and to the presidency, even with all of the, as much as we revile particular people who hold the office, sometimes with good reason, there's still a reverence, there's still a longing for Camelot, and there's still this view that the president should be the one who teaches your children well, and who, you know, when there's a threat to your children, answers the phone at 3 o'clock in the morning to keep them safe, and you know, can bring us all together behind a great national calling. As long as this grandiose view of what the presidency is for, this view that's, 180 degrees away from the modest, business-like, unromantic view that the framers took, as long as Americans cling to this modern view of the presidency, I don't think any of these legislative reforms, even if they pass, are going to stick. So there really needs to be a change in public sentiment and a change in what we ask of the presidency. Because unless we change what we ask of the presidency, we're going to get more of the same. Thanks for listening.